deserts and streams, the rise of Dos Cabezas, and the outlaws I see in my dreams.
This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways Magazine. The first article is from the December 1996 issue and is entitled Caroling with the Pima Indians at Sagaton by Tom Kuhn. The Pimas arrived raising dust, with car doors slamming, children laughing, and dogs barking. I had been waiting for them, an invited guest. Everyone bustled over to a small house, gathered before a front door lit by a bare bulb. Eleanor J., 77, had been waiting for their knock. Tinsel and colored bulbs decorated her living room. A corn offering hung on the wall. For her, the ritual of La Posada, a reenactment of the search by Joseph and Mary for lodging just before the birth of Christ, was an annual custom anticipated with pleasure. Ever since it started, she said, I've been having them come by. But she was not sure how many more La Posada celebrations there would be for her. On the sixth day before Christmas, she would enter the Gila River Hospital. The prognosis was uncertain. She worried about her son, Reese, who lived next door. In the time since last Christmas, his wife had died and a daughter had been killed in an auto accident. As we entered her home, I thought about how differently the Pimas observed La Posada compared with the carnival-like celebrations of Mexico. These people were Jay's neighbors, friends, and fellow parishioners. They had come to offer her cheer and hope. They blessed her home. In parting, they touched her hand lightly, one by one, as they filed back into the chilly night. They reenacted La Posada once again at the Sun's home. Half the singers, accompanied by guitars, remained outside to begin the refrain. Two pilgrims we pray you in God's name for shelter, my poor wife is wearing in cold winter weather. From inside, the group responded until finally came the ritual permission. We open our door now. All 18 of us packed the living room, singing carols. Reese J. looked stricken as the carolers filed past him out the door. I do it, La Posada, in my wife's honor, he said, but it hurts a little, too. His perseverance touched me. How wonderful to be back for Christmas in a small town like Sacaton, where one's successes and sorrows seem to travel on the wind and where people care. The Pimas pride themselves on caring for neighbors and friends. They have taken in travelers since 1605, when the Spanish arrived, and later American settlers and adventurers, including legendary Indian scout Kit Carson. La Posada groups circulate through each of the 8 political districts of the rural Gila River Indian Reservation, 30 miles south of Phoenix. During the 9 days before Christmas, they perform at more than 425 homes. On our list was the new tract home of Oscar and Tracy Ortega and their daughter, one-year-old Jasmine. There the news was good, and signs of prosperity were evident. Oscar was employed in Sacaton, the Pima government headquarters, where jobs were scarce. Christmas decorations hung from the ceiling, gift stockings from the wall. The home glowed with colored lights. This is something we've done for years since I was a kid, Tracy explained, but this is the first time in this house, she added proudly. We asked them to come and bless it. It's a tradition. The tradition of La Posada began in Spain, traveled to Spanish America, then was trekked into the northern Indian rancherias by Franciscan missionaries. The Pimas adopted the Roman Catholic custom from the Tohono O'odham, close relations whose reservation borders Mexico. Eighth grade teacher Holly Anton, a Pima who lives in Santa Rosa among the Tohono O'odham, had driven 90 minutes over 50 miles of rural road to join the Sacaton carolers. Tohono O'odham groups had brought La Posada to her home. She enjoyed the spectacle and decided to join one in Sacaton, where she was born. When I come here, she said, I know how to do it. The Sacaton group did not practice beforehand. We just got together and started singing, said Carol Jackson. A lot of the adults are in the Christmas choir, and the children learned the same songs in school. The La Posada carolers crisscrossed Sagatan, home to 5,000 Pimas, night after night, acting out the Holy Family's search for lodging. They were expected. I was a stranger, but welcomed. Darkness was closing around low mountains to the east when we arrived at the home of Delvin Davis, a tribal substance abuse counselor, and his wife, Thelma. Their house blazed with a spotlighted Santa, reindeer cutouts pranced on the roof, and dozens of colored bulbs blinked along the eaves. To the north, faintly glowing on the horizon, Phoenix with its high-rise buildings seemed far away. The Pimas haven't entirely relinquished symbols of the old ways. Even in a contented Christian home like the Davises, there were holdout signs, a corn offering, a wall hanging of the Pima motif, man in a maze, symbolizing man's search for meaning. We walked in on a strained mood at the home of Ina Blaine. Outlines on the wall revealed where pictures had recently been removed. Blaine, her son, and her daughter sat stone-faced on the fireplace hearth while Christmas carols were sung and the home blessed. Then it was time to leave. As caroler Ellison Elmay reached for Blaine's hand, both suddenly hugged each other and cried. "We grew up together," Elmay said, wiping away tears. "She's having some troubles now." The house felt empty after the carolers left. I lingered and asked Blaine why she invited them. "I needed it," she said. "Yes, I needed it." At Arlene Scherz's house, where three of her 11 grandchildren live with her, a Christmas tree and presents were accompanied by a man in the maze hanging. When the singing started, Scherz joined in with her guitar. In keeping with custom, she served cookies and soft drinks before we re-entered the night. Venus hovering in the southwestern sky provided a stand-in for the nativity star. The Pima lands recalled the arid grasslands between Bethlehem and Nazareth. Our caravan got underway again. At a ranch-style house on a paved street in a fenced compound for non-Indian government workers, we called on Grace Hill, an emergency room nurse at the Sacaton Indian Hospital, and her mother, Margaret Beiser, 86. "My mom is ill," Hill confided. Betty Whitman, a Pima caroler who worked with Hill, brought La Posada to the sick woman. As the Pimas sang, Mrs. Beiser clapped weakly. A liturgy was read. "I will make a new beginning with those who are left." The carolers were middle-aged, young parents, teenagers, mostly women. Lou Ray, 9, wearing a Santa hat with a battery-powered tassel, blinked like a beacon in their midst. "I had never seen the ceremony before," Hill said. "It's just beautiful." On another night, we accepted an invitation to join a La Posada group making the rounds in Bapchol from St. Peter's Church and School Mission, located in an intensely farmed district where the family of Iwo Jima flag raiser Ira Hayes once lived. As we set out for the mission, a huge United States Marine Corps standard stood straight out in a Sonoran wind, whooping through the Pima Cemetery across the street. Two blocks away, La Posada carolers arrived at the home of Glenn Hayes, a distant cousin of Ira. The family sat arrayed on a couch in the living room. We squeezed in and surrounded them with song. Later, I asked about Ira's family. "They're all gone. They all died," Hayes said. "The Ira Hayes place is closed now." The Bapchul La Posada reenactments stressed ritual more. The carolers sang more songs and stayed longer. Even more so than in Sacaton, the Pimas at Bapchul are closely tied by marriage and blood kinship. In every house we visited, someone was related to one of the La Posada carolers. The living room of Henrietta Antone, 63, and her husband, Manuel Hernandez Sr., 59, was brimming with people for La Posada. She had 10 children, 31 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. Many of them had come for the caroling. "I would like my house blessed so everything will be all right," Anton said. "It should help us to be better for the next year." I had always wanted to see inside a Pima sandwich house of adobe reinforced with exterior wood lathes. They are reportedly cool in summer, warm in winter. Melvin Webb, 61, and his wife of 30 years, Elizabeth, 59, invited us into theirs. Even though their 2 children were grown and they now lived alone, La Posada had become an annual fair look forward to. We have the carolers come every year, wherever we are, Elizabeth said. I could smell the delicious scent of gingerbread wafting from the kitchen of Florist Clieton before we got inside. Candy-filled stockings hung on the wall. In the living room, regal and seated ramrod straight, were George Clieton, 83, and his wife Dorothy, 72. Theirs was the first Indian-sounding surname I had encountered among the Pimas. Franciscan sister Juana Lucero, a Pima who teaches the Pima language as a cultural experience class for Bapchul grade schoolers, resolved the mystery. Missionaries, she said, renamed all the Pimas in 1922. They made them go to the headquarters in Sacaton and gave them English names, she said. The names were put on government lists, and as they baptized the children, they gave them English names. The Spanish were on the south end of the reservation, and those Pimas got Spanish names. That's when all the dances disappeared, she lamented. The missionaries made the Pima women wear Mother Hubbard-style dresses, which made dancing impossible. The Pimas have broadly adopted Christianity in rituals like La Posada. Catholics, Presbyterians, and Baptists predominate. However, drums sometimes accompany lay services, and some still cling to the traditional spiritual beliefs. I learned from Sister Ann Fisher, who lives in Sacaton and serves as a Catholic pastoral assistant to the Pimas, that several men still perform smoke blessings and infant initiation ceremonies. Shamans still attract followers. Such things seem far apart from La Posada reenactments and houses strung with lights as the Pimas devoutly celebrated Christmas renewal and hope. But I had not missed noticing that in nearly every house we visited, there were corn offerings to old spirits. The next article is entitled The Miner's Daughter and the Night Before Christmas by Don Shelley. Next year, said the mother, Christmas will be different, my child. Why, we'll have real presents, not just those homemade things, and we'll have candles for the tree, and for dinner we'll have roast goose with apple stuffing and all the trimmings, and plum pudding, Mama? Yes, dear, and plum pudding. The woman took down her sewing and leaned across the table and placed her hand on her daughter's hand and squeezed it. Tears welled in her mother's eyes, and the girl wished she could reach out and wipe them away forever, and with them the hurt, the loss that were behind the tears. Too well the girl remembered that September night when the tears began. The terrifying shriek of the steam whistle had awakened her, an accident at the mine, and she had lain sleepless in her bed, knowing somehow, yet not really knowing, not believing until close to morning when the company men in dark blue suits came to the door. Cave-in, three dead, her father! Though barely 11, she was the oldest of four children, and on the day they buried her father, her mother took her aside and shared her intention to remain in that house, that town. We'll manage, the mother said. I'll take in laundry and I'll do sewing. There's no money now for us to go elsewhere, and goodness knows, Arizona Territory is the only home you children know. Though not a place known for its beauty or charm, mining town seldom are, it was a pleasant place built upon mountain slopes and within a few minutes' walk of the copper mine, which was the sole reason for the town's being, and it was home. So they remained in the small house, and if times had been hard before, they were even harder now. Her mother's hands never were idle, and each day, it seemed, the girl saw new wrinkles in her tired face. But somehow they managed. Each month the rent was paid on time, and though not new, the children's clothes always were clean and mended, and not once had the little ones gone to bed hungry. The girl helped, too. She worked every day after school, all day Saturday, and sometimes on Sunday, for the wife of the mine superintendent. The girl cleaned house and did the laundry and looked after the baby, and there was nothing else to be done. She helped in the kitchen. The money she earned she gave to her mother to help out, save those few coins she secretly held back each week, which she wrapped in a hanky and kept hidden beneath her mattress. So yes, they had managed, they had made do, but as the days passed and Christmas neared, all of them missed the one who was gone, and now on the night before Christmas, with the little ones in bed, the girl and mother spoke of him. I miss Pa, said the girl. I miss him something awful. Her mother smiled, but there was sadness in the smile. So do I, child. We all do, but we have our memories. I know, Mama, but that's not the same. It's not like it was when he was here with us. The mother brushed at a curl that had fallen over her forehead. "No, it's not the same, but we can never have more than that. We must be thankful for those memories." The two sat alone in the kitchen, and the mother cleared her throat and, shaking her head, told the girl she wished there were more presents beneath the tree for her children. The mother made apologies for the muffler, the sweater, the mittens, the made-over dress, practical things, homemade things, the fruits of a loving mother's toils. "But there would be oranges for the stockings," said the mother, brightening, "and a few nuts, a piece of candy, a Christmas cookie. But just you wait until next year, child. It'll be some Christmas with real presents, toys, and surprises." The mother sat quietly for a few moments, alone with her thoughts, her memories. Then she rose, kissed the girl, and wished her good night. It had been a long day, she said wearily, and tomorrow would be a longer one. She asked her daughter to attend to things, to close up for the night, and then she retired. So the girl sat alone at the table. From the parlor came the flickering glow of the candle the little ones had placed in the front window to light the way for Mary and Joseph. And on the parlor table, beside the Christmas tree they had cut and brought down from the mountains above town, sat the cookie and glass of milk her sisters and brother left for Santa Claus. Before she went to sleep, the girl would blow out the candle, and she would drink the milk and nibble the cookie, leaving a scatter of crumbs on the tabletop so the little ones would know Santa had enjoyed his treat. But first there was something else she must tend to. When she was certain her mother was in bed and asleep, she slipped quietly into her own bedroom and got the small package, a present for her mother, from his hiding place beneath the mattress, Memories. It was one evening not long before he died that she had walked with her father to the mine, and they paused at the display window of the company store to look at the many fine things. "See that fan?" he said, tapping the window pane with a stubby finger. "I'm going to buy it for your mother. Christmas present." The girl's eyes widened as she looked at the fan, an exquisite thing of black lace and glimmering mother of pearl. Surely there wasn't anything quite that elegant in the whole town, she thought, in all Arizona territory for that matter. "It's a present fit for a lady," Pa had said, "and there's not a grander lady anywhere than your mother." The coins in the hanky were not quite enough to pay for the fan, but the store manager had known her father, and he smiled and pushed it across the counter to the girl and wished her a Merry Christmas. The girl looked one more time at the card and the package. "From Pa," she had written. She placed the present beneath the Christmas tree, hiding it under packages that held the muffler, the sweater, the mittens, the made-over dress. This concludes The Miner's Daughter and the Night Before Christmas. The next article is entitled A Foundling in the Wilderness by William C. Barnes. The story was first published by Arizona Highways in February 1936. It was Christmas Day sometime in the 1870s. The westbound mail stage swung around the point of a ridge 100 yards east of Horsehead Crossing, Arizona. Then, about 2 miles east of Holbrook, was an early day stage station, a Navajo trading post on the line of the overland mail route from Santa Fe, New Mexico, to Prescott, Arizona. As soon as the dust from the stage was seen, the station awakened. The handful of loafers in the saloon sauntered out onto the brush and dirt-covered porch to watch the arrival of the stage, which was, in fact, the event of the day. Everybody about the place, even the dogs, came to life. The station was on the north side of the Little Colorado River, just below the point where the Rio Puerco, Spanish for Dirty River, joined it from the east. It was made up of a general store, the inevitable frontier saloon, the stage station, a post office, corrals, together with half a dozen rough adobe buildings scattered around in a grove of grand old cottonwood trees. Off to one side were a few Navajo hogans used by the Indians when they came in from their reservation to trade with the storekeeper and sell their wool and blankets. The so-called stage actually was a rickety yellow buckboard drawn by a couple of broncos. It was piled high with mail, sacks, and baggage. A single, weary, dust-covered passenger climbed down from its seat. The driver tossed the reins to a Mexican who, having unhitched the animals from the buckboard, led them off to a corral for water and feed. A fresh team would take their place when the westward journey was resumed. The passenger followed the driver into the station where dinner was ready in the dining room. A blue-eyed, golden-haired young girl waited on them. The passenger watched her with deep interest. The station keeper, Bernardo Frey, who sat with his guest, called her Christmas. The passenger looked inquiringly at the man. "Odd name, that," he remarked. "How come?" The girl had disappeared into the kitchen. The station keeper smiled. "About 8 years ago, the eastbound stage found the burned remains of a buckboard standing beside the road on the west side of the LaRue Wash, about 4 miles west of here. As the driver pulled up his team, a couple of ravens rose into the air with shrill and noisy caws. A man and a woman, both almost naked, lay dead near a cold campfire. All signs pointed to either Indian or white outlaws. Their two horses had been killed and the camp looted, and what things the murderers couldn't carry off with them had been thrown onto the campfire and burned to ashes. Even the buckboard had been partially burned. A short distance from the camp, under a bunch of ironwoods where the dead ones had evidently made their bed, lay a piece of heavy canvas. The driver lifted the one corner of it, and there lay a child, a little girl, sound asleep, evidently worn out from crying and hunger. Just why she had been spared, we have never been able to discover. She was possibly a little over 3 years old and could tell us nothing of what happened or who the people were whose dead bodies lay in the lonely roadside camp. After a hurried examination, the stage driver brought the little one here, where we did everything we could to comfort her. She soon forgot the terrible experience she had been through. Possibly she was asleep through it all and never knew just what had happened. Of course, as soon as the stage left, we went back to the deserted camp to bury the dead and, if possible, discover something as to their identity. But though we searched for hours in and around the deserted camp, not a single shred of evidence could we find as to who they were, where they came from, or where they were going. Everything had been burned. We buried the two in one grave and put over it a large cross made from the tongue of the buckboard, which had not been completely burned. You will see the grave close to the road just after crossing the wash on your way west. My wife and I adopted the little one and named her Christmas for the day she came to us. We couldn't love her more if she was our very own flesh and blood. A few days later, two hard-looking hombres rode into the station. They were well-mounted and led a heavily loaded pack mule. They put their stock in the corral and announced they would stay for the night. They both seemed rather sullen and uncommunicative and evidently were not seeking human companionship. They did manage to inform us that they came from over Prescott way and were going to New Mexico, but that was all we learned about them. That evening, over at the bar, after tanking up pretty aplenty, the two picked a quarrel with the barkeep. Old Bill was ordinarily peaceable enough, but a mighty hard man to put anything over on. Also, he was quick on the trigger. When we got there, the two bad men were lying on the floor, deader than Julius Caesar, and the barkeep had a big hole in his left shoulder from a .45 bullet, which went plumb through and come out the other side. We did some tough and ready surgery work, stopped the flow of blood, and inside of a month, old Bill was almost as good as ever. Barkeeps were mostly built that way in them days. In the outlaws' pack, we found all the evidence we needed to prove they were the chaps who had killed the man and woman and burned their outfit in camp over on the LaRue Wash. But here again, we were plumb stumped, for, believe it or not, there wasn't a single thing to show who the dead man and woman were, and by the same token, there wasn't a shred of evidence to identify the two murderers. We went through their stuff with a fine-tooth comb, but not a thing in the outfit told us a word. They had quite a wad of money with them, which, with their horses, saddles, bedding, and other plunder, we turned over to the sheriff, who happened along a few days later. The sheriff didn't have any better luck than we did in finding out who the chaps were, so after keeping the horses and other plunder for a year, the stuff was sold by the probate judge, according to the laws of Arizona. With the money found on the two men and what came from the sale of their effects, it made quite a nice little sum, which was turned over to me as the girl's legal guardian and foster father. I put the money in the bank at Albuquerque in her name, and someday, maybe so, it will come in handy to buy her a wedding outfit. You will see the graves of the two men over there in the sage flat yonder. We planted them there after the shooting. Nope, we never yet have told the little girl about what happened to the folks she was with. Maybe so never will. Anyhow, not till she's grown up and old enough to understand what it all means to her. You can see the grave about a half mile west of the wash going up the slope. Mean to put a regular stone marker over it one of these days when some stonecutter chap comes along. The grave where the young couple was buried lies close to the old Holbrook-Winslow wagon road on the west slope of LaRue Wash. Some years later, a plain slab of red sandstone from a nearby cliff was set up over the grave as a marker, but nothing carved on it. After the Santa Fe Railroad reached Holbrook, a post office was opened there on September 18, 1882. This caused the abandonment of the old stage station and post office, which was first established about 1870. Bernardo Frey, or Old Man Bernardo, as he was best known, then closed down his business and moved to Albuquerque. Presumably, he took with him the young girl of the story, but what became of her, the writer has not been able to learn, although diligent inquiry has been made from time to time. All that remains of the incident is the lone headstone on the west side of LaRue Wash, a few miles west of Holbrook. This concludes A Foundling in the Wilderness. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
I love you, Arizona. Your mountains, deserts, and streams. Rise of Dos Cabezas and the outlaws I see in my dreams. I love you, Arizona.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Log on to sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. In addition, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.